Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, accepting nominations now for the 2019 James Irvine Foundation Leadership Awards at irvine.org. The California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the healthcare they need, on the web at chcf.org. And the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org.
From Valley Public Radio, serving Central California from Bakersfield to Merced, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, we dig into the local history of accused Golden State killer Joseph James DeAngelo. The former Exeter police officer is also suspected of being the so-called Visalia ransacker, a suspect behind numerous burglaries and a murder in Tulare County in the 1970s. Plus, is the 22nd congressional district still safe for Republicans and Devin Nunes? We'll learn why some political analysts are starting to pay closer attention to the race. That and a look at turmoil in Armenia, as that nation with close ties to the San Joaquin Valley undergoes what some are calling the April Revolution. We'll find out what it means for locals. Right now, though, we begin today's program with another report in our ongoing series about air quality. Air pollution in the San Joaquin Valley has improved dramatically over the last few decades, partly thanks to a set of sweeping clean air laws passed in the early 2000s in Sacramento. Over the last few years, however, one major polluting practice has risen steadily. And although it's unclear if the increase has had an impact on air quality, advocates are concerned it will if the trend continues. FM 89's Carrie Klein reports from a family farm outside of Fresno on what's being done about ag burning.
Because of the nature of his job, John Nail sometimes loses sleep over the weather. It happened a few weeks ago.
I'm sitting in bed and you hear the, you know, the wind noise, right?
All Nail could think about was the wind gusting through his grapevines and almond trees north of Kerman. Sure enough, his fears were warranted.
We lost 21 trees in this orchard, and we'll be coming through here and cleaning them up and sawing them up and pulling them out.
He didn't just lose 21 trees worth of almonds.
We're getting close to pit hardening, but not quite.
He also now has to clear his land. When he started farming in the 1990s, getting rid of that material would have been simple.
We'd chop up the limbs, we'd drag the limbs, we'd lay them across the row, we'd bring a tractor in with the little brush rake, we call it, and we'd push these things into a little pile, and we'd light that match.
But today, Nail can't do that so easily.
Because they don't allow us to burn.
A law passed in 2003 made open ag burning illegal without a permit. Those permits are costly and can take months to process. By 2011, open ag burning had dropped by 80%. It was no longer the valley's second largest source of particulate matter. And yet, despite no change in the law, the Air District has quietly allowed the practice to quadruple in the last 4 years. Valley growers burned more in 2017 than they did in 2005, the year the law went into effect. Air regulators blame a lack of other options. Air quality advocates, they see regulators neglecting their responsibilities. But growers see burning as a solution to a desperate need to clear land.
If you have a mortgage payment, you know, and that is your income, you need that producing. You need that. You need to get that. I need to get it back in production as fast as I can.
The most common reason for burning is the removal of vineyards and orchards. Imagine the amount of biomass in hundreds of acres of pulled up grapevines. Getting a burn permit from the San Joaquin Valley Air District isn't easy. Growers need to let their material dry for weeks or months. They need to show they can't afford the other options. Then, Deputy Control Officer Morgan Lambert says the district has a quota for how many acres can burn on any given day, and that only on clear days.
And so I think a lot of times that's misunderstood. People think people can just burn whenever they want or however much they want to burn. It's very strictly controlled and strictly managed.
For a while, the most promising alternative was to run the trees through a wood chipper and haul the chips off to biomass incinerators, which burn the chips to produce electricity. But in the last decade, many nearby biomass facilities have shuttered, and those still open are overloaded with dead trees from the Sierra.
Unfortunately, we've come to kind of almost like a perfect storm of all these different circumstances that have come into effect over the last couple of years.
For a time, the Air District was considering loosening its restrictions on ag burning. But Lambert said they changed course after a summit on burning alternatives last fall.
The action that our governing board has taken has been to not roll back those restrictions and to focus our efforts moving forward on actually trying to advance technology and to bring resources to help incentivize, you know, newer technologies.
Still, Dolores Barajas-Weller of the Central Valley Air Quality Coalition argues the Air District is too lenient in granting burn permits.
I don't have a lot of confidence in the smoke management practices of the Air District based on what we have seen.
She says the Air District should be working harder to incentivize pilot projects on dealing with ag waste. Tom France agrees. He's an almond grower and air quality advocate in Shafter.
There's an alternative for that biomass, and that's to put it back into the soil.
He says, think compost. Once those dead trees have been chipped, growers can work the chips back into their fields.
It's the simplest, most obvious thing you could do, and it's extremely beneficial to the soil and the new trees that you plant in that soil.
And that's a nice full nut. You're going to have some nice quality crop here.
To John Nail, even that option isn't easy. He doesn't have the equipment to disc the chips into his soil, so he has to hire contractors and potentially wait months for them. Still, he understands what's improved over the last few decades and what's at stake.
I can see the coastal mountain range now way more than I used to, way more.
He's still figuring out what to do with his 21 fallen almond trees. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Carrie Klein.
California's June primary is just 35 days away, and some local races are starting to heat up. One of them is in a congressional district that hasn't seen a close race in years. FM89's Laura Tsutsui reports on how the 22nd congressional district is drawing renewed national and local attention.
Hi, I'm calling for Herlinda. My name's Ashley. I'm a volunteer on behalf of Andrew Jans.
Ashley Davis is an 18-year-old student from Central High School, and she's spending her Thursday night calling voters in the 22nd Congressional District.
He's a local Democratic prosecutor from Visalia, and he's running against...
Davis has never voted before. This will be her first election. She and five others are sitting in a West Fresno office volunteering for the Andrew Jans campaign. They're hoping to flip the 22nd Congressional District from Republican to Democrat. Political analysts say the likelihood of that happening is slim. The majority of registered voters are Republicans, and the incumbent, Congressman Devin Nunes, has held the seat for 15 years. But for the first time, Nunes is up against a candidate with a strong ability to fundraise and historic trends that suggest Republican seats aren't as safe as usual. Kyle Kondik is the managing editor of Larry Sabato's Crystal Ball, a nonpartisan newsletter published by the University of Virginia's Center for Politics.
I think we're still trying to figure out how good of a campaign Jans is going to run. You know, fundraising is not everything. It's a good thing to have some money, but at the very least, it's good for Democrats to have somebody who may be credible running in this district. And so I think Jans is doing his party a favor just by running this race and giving voters an actual alternative.
Kondik says midterms often follow similar patterns. The party in power often loses seats, and an unpopular president can mean trouble for the party he represents. Last week, Sabato's Crystal Ball forecast for House races revised its ratings for Nunes' district. The district was considered safe Republican, but now is rated likely Republican, which is a step away from a confident win.
I think the next big milestone that I'm looking at is the primary. Maybe if Nunes wins, you know, by a ton, maybe that would cause us to sort of reevaluate the other way it moves back to safe.
Kondik says it's hard to make predictions about House races because there isn't reliable polling to back it up. If District 22 follows the trends that suggest Republicans may end up losing seats this year, Nunes could be looking at a more competitive race than he's used to. In the past, Nunes has relied on turning out the conservative base in his district. It encompasses most of North Fresno, all of Clovis, and curves around East Fresno to include Reedley, Visalia, and Nunes' hometown of Tulare. So far, Democrat Andrew Jans has distinguished himself as the biggest threat. The Fresno County prosecutor has raised over $1 million, which is much more than the other Democratic candidates, but still well under the $2.5 million Nunes has raised. Other challengers in the race include Democrats Bobby Blytout and Ricardo Franco, Libertarian Bill Merriman, and Brian Carroll, who isn't affiliated with a party. Nunes is the only Republican running. Fresno State political science professor Tom Holyoke says that any Democrat running for the seat has their work cut out for them.
The district was essentially created to be a Republican district. So in many ways, it's natural for a Republican to represent it. So Andrew Jans, indeed any Democrat, is going to be swimming upstream.
Holyoke says that Jans is certainly putting in the legwork. Jans has cleared a hurdle by fundraising so much, which can help with name recognition. But Holyoke says that's not the only thing Jans is trying to leverage.
I do get the impression that Andrew Jans has made some headway with this argument that Devin Nunes has become an absentee congressman, that he just is not around in the district very often. He's not appearing at events. He's not holding town meetings. He's not held town meetings in years.
Holyoke also says that Nunes might not benefit from the national attention he's been getting lately, and some might consider him too close to the president.
Because to an extent, this race is going to be about President Trump as much as it's about anything. All of the House races this year are going to be about President Trump. The Democrats very much think that they can run on a position of opposing President Trump.
But that association with the president could be a positive for some. I met 22nd Congressional District voters at the Clovis Rodeo Parade Saturday to ask what they think. Henry Espinoza is one Republican voter who isn't a huge fan of Trump, but agrees with his policies.
He wants to make America strong again, and we've lost that to the world.
Espinoza lives in Nunes's district, and he isn't too bothered by his absence or his close ties to the president.
As long as he's doing his job, in Washington, you know, that's what we pay him for. And his votes are what counts, and his speaking of all these issues that pertain to this district. I haven't heard nothing bad about his political agenda as far as character flaws and everything. Like I said, everybody's got their character flaws, and you can't please everybody.
Espinoza says that he and his wife just got their voter information guides in the mail. They plan on reviewing them before they vote in the primary this June. Despite the low probability the 22nd District's congressman is a Democrat, there is the possibility that Democrats win enough seats to hold a majority in the House, which Sabatow's crystal ball rates at a 50-50 chance. The primary election is June 5th, and the top two congressional candidates in the 22nd District will compete for the seat this November. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Laura Satsui.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. The news of the arrest of a man suspected of being the Golden State Killer shocked the nation last week. 72-year-old Joseph James DeAngelo is accused of being behind a string of murders, rapes, and robberies that also earned the suspect the titles the East Area Rapist and the Original Night Stalker. The former police officer is also suspected of being the so-called Visalia Ransacker, a suspect behind numerous burglaries and a murder in Tulare County in the 1970s. To tell us more, we have with us Paul Myers. He's a reporter and editor with the Foothills Sun-Gazette in Exeter. Paul, welcome.
Hi.
Exeter really jumped into this story last week when it came out that not only was Joseph James DeAngelo suspect in the Golden State Killer murders, but also in the incidents in Tulare County, and the key fact that DeAngelo was for a time in the early 1970s a member of the Exeter Police Department. What do we know about his time in Tulare County right now?
Well, so what we know for sure is that he was, like you said, a member of the Exeter Police Department. And oddly enough, on the Wednesday when he was arrested, so we were tipped that he may have been a police officer. So we called the Exeter Police Department, and I spoke with their police chief, John Hall. And he said, well, you know, we're going to be looking into it. He gave me a call back a couple hours later, and, you know, we had been searching through our archives, kind of trying to find as much as we could. And before he got a chance to call me back, we saw in an August issue of 1973 of the Exeter Sun that he was introduced as a police officer starting in like May 18th, 1973. And then I got a call back from the police chief, and he said that they had no records of any city personnel from the 70s at all. So we got very fortunate that we had those archives with us. And just yesterday, I was working on the story, and I was going through the years between 73 and 76, whenever he was here, trying to find out, you know, if there were any cases that he had worked on or anything of any kind of public note that we had documented. And, you know, there weren't too many cases of note in the newspapers that he was on. That being said, during the same time, there was the Visalia Ransacker, as you had said. And the funny thing is about the Visalia Ransacker, that name really wasn't even brought up until after he had left the area. So during the time that he was allegedly breaking into all these homes, people were just scared. They didn't really know what to call him. And although police knew that it was the same guy, kind of given the MO of things that he would do during his break-ins, all that we know officially is that he's a suspect for the Visalia Ransacker case at this point, and he's a suspect for the Claude Snelling murder from September 11th, 1975, I want to say.
And that was the College of Sequoia's journalist and professor who was brutally murdered in one of those incidents by the man they call the Visalia Ransacker. You mentioned that your newspaper's archives provided some information about Mr. D'Angelo. What about people in Exeter? Does anyone alive today have any recollection of his time in Tulare County?
Well, there were a few folks that had reached out to us that were actually kind of concerned with some suspicious murders that had occurred around the same time that they think may be the same guy. Although we've reached out to some cold case detectives, and they said that they haven't quite been able to piece that together. Other than that, you know, there weren't too many folks around here who kind of put, you know, the Visalia Ransacker together with any of the Exeter robberies. Although while I was going through the archives for the Exeter Sun, there was actually a spike in burglaries, and where there were similar things taken in Exeter homes where there were in Visalia homes, like small trinkets and like watches and like almost personal belongings and some like collector's items like silver dollars and coins. Which was something that he would take often as well, women's clothing and ID cards too, certain things like that. Although nobody who had their home broken into in Exeter really kind of came forward to say, I think that was him, because I think that there were probably quite a few other burglaries happening at the same time from other people. Although in Visalia, a lot of folks via social media have kind of reached out saying like that their home was ransacked during this time, and we had reached out to a local historian who used to be a Visalia police officer for, I want to say, 26 or 30 years, who was working in Visalia at the time, and we asked him what kind of the tenor was like in the, you know, during this period of time between 73 and 76, and he was telling us that, you know, he would be out on patrol and he would arrest somebody for anything like a traffic stop or, you know, something of the sort, and then residents would come up to him and say, "Oh, is that the guy that's been breaking into the houses?" And he would say, "Well, no, but it was an indicator that it was on the mind of everybody in Visalia."
What about the mood in the community today? Exeter being a small town, really being on the national spotlight now, as all the stories from AP to CNN and beyond all referencing Joseph James D'Angelo, former police officer in Exeter, California. Is the community still buzzing about this?
I think so, because, you know, I grew up in Exeter, so a lot of folks around here have, you know, always said like, well, you know, Exeter is a very special place. There's not a lot of crime here. No community is, you know, is without any crime. But, their feeling was, I think it's a little bit of ambivalence. Like they are very glad that they live in Exeter now, but they are somewhat a little bit shocked that something like this, that a man like this kind of worked through the police force without ever being caught. And so I think that has also kind of led to this feeling of, you know, famousness of some kind. I'm not exactly sure the term I would use. They're certainly not accustomed to the type of publicity that they're getting as of late. And to be honest, neither are we. We've had so many phone calls from folks trying to get the photos of the headshot that we found in our archives. And our phone was ringing off the hook just trying to get that PDF version, you know, from New York and Good Morning America and People's Magazine. It's just something that we're definitely not accustomed to either.
So last week, after the Ventura County and Sacramento County District Attorneys had their press conference in Sacramento to announce the arrest of Joseph James DeAngelo, the Visalia Police Chief had his own press conference saying that they were again looking into this new development in the case of the Visalia ransacker and the evidence that may exist, potentially tying Joseph James DeAngelo to those crimes. What's the status there, especially given the fact that the statute of limitations on burglaries would have already expired?
Yeah, that was very funny. I was actually just working on that portion of our story. So what we kind of pieced together is that the Visalia Police Department doesn't have a lot of DNA in these cases. So it's kind of anybody's guess as to where they go to from here. And then, like you said, the statute of limitations are already passed on residential burglaries. I think it's 3 years. And so really what they would be looking at is the murder of Professor Snelling. And from what I can tell and from what I heard, I don't think that there is a lot of DNA evidence in that case that they kept. So I'm not sure if they'll have anything to be able to prosecute this case.
It's fascinating as this continues to march through the headlines and more comes out here. We've been talking with the editor and reporter of the Foothills Sun-Gazette in Exeter, Paul Myers. He's been following the story of Joseph James DeAngelo, the man accused of being the Golden State Killer, arrested last week in a story that shocked the nation, and also suspected of being the man called the Visalia Ransacker, a suspect in numerous residential burglaries and a murder in Tulare County in the 1970s. He just so happened to also be a member of the Exeter Police Department during that same period. We'll continue to follow Paul's coverage of this story in the Foothills Sun-Gazette. Paul, thank you so much for taking the time today.
Thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Last week, protests clogged the streets of Armenia's capital, Yerevan, into what some are calling the April Revolution. The demonstrations resulted in the resignation of the Republic's Prime Minister, Serge Sargsyan. His decision was announced one day before the nation marked the anniversary of the Armenian genocide. The change in power marks a turning point in Armenian affairs and the end of a 20-year-long streak in power for Armenia's Republican Party. So what does this mean for Armenians in America and for the rest of the world? Given the context of recent Russian involvement in the Ukraine and, of course, Russian meddling in the U.S. presidential election, what role is Russia playing in Armenia? Here to tell us more is Fresno State Armenian Studies Professor Barlo Dermirgodichian. Barlo, welcome.
Thank you, Joe.
So let's start out with sort of the lay of the land before the so-called April Revolution began. Who was Serge Sargsyan, and what were his politics of the party in power there?
Serge Sargsyan was a member of the ruling party. Now, that ruling party has had different sort of reiterations or different types of lives, different names. But he was part of the sort of the ruling class of Armenia, which really began with his predecessor, Robert Kocharyan. Both of them are actually from Karabakh, and they and their friends formed this party, which is today called the Republican Party, and it became the platform for him to become president of Armenia. However, that presidency was even tarnished because when elections took place in 2008, there were demonstrations, and actually some of the demonstrators were fired upon and killed.
So with the overall issue of Armenian politics, certainly the Soviet Union, a former republic. Armenia was a former republic of the Soviet Union, and Russian politics also looms large here. How does Russia fit into this equation?
Serge Sargsyan was seen as being very pro-Russian, but that's not unusual for Armenia because Russia is so influential in many areas of Armenia's economy, of its politics, of its military. There's still Russian troops based in Armenia protecting the border with Turkey. So all of these are levers that Russia can use to influence Armenia to really stay within the Russian orbit, as opposed to moving closer with perhaps Europe or the United States.
So you also mentioned that Sargsyan is from Karabakh. Tell us about that territory and why it's significant.
Karabakh is a piece of land, I'll call it a territory, which was formerly within the administrative jurisdiction of Azerbaijan, the Republic of Azerbaijan, in the Soviet period. However, in 1988, the Armenians in that region began to demonstrate for self-determination, and they actually passed a referendum where they wanted to be freed from Azeri rule and moved to Armenian rule. The Azerbaijanis didn't like it, and a war started from 1989 until 1994. The Armenians there won. They declared themselves, in the meanwhile, an independent republic, but they are not recognized by any other country in the world, and there are negotiations which have been going on for more than 20 years to try to settle that issue.
And where do the United States and Russia fall on that issue?
Well, on that issue, Russia and the United States, as well as France and some of the other major powers, form this group, which is called the OSCE group, who's tasked with trying to find a solution to the problem. However, just recently, within the last year, Azerbaijan has been threatening Armenia and Karabakh, and actually has attacked Karabakh unprovoked. So the level of tension there has been very high.
So Serge Sargsyan out in power in Yerevan. Now, who is behind the opposition? I understand there's this journalist turned politician, Nikol Pashinyan. Tell me about him and the people who led this protest.
Well, it's interesting because Nikol Pashinyan was actually seen as being a leader of a very small group in the Armenian parliament. So the threshold of becoming a party that is represented in the parliament was 5% of the popular vote. And his political party just barely made it. So he was seen as being sort of a fringe figure, I would say, although he had spoken out against the government policies. He really didn't have a great following that I saw before this. But then suddenly it resonated. His message resonated with people. And he began to walk up and down the country, literally, and demonstrators began to gather. It became hundreds, then thousands, then tens of thousands. And really, it was the trigger for it was Serge Sargsyan, who was the former president, because Armenia has changed its system of government from a presidential system to a parliamentary system. Serge Sargsyan was simply going to move over to become prime minister, which would have continued his power. And that was a move that triggered these mass protests and put Pashinyan in a place that he can now, we can say, has power.
What are the main issues that are driving this concern amongst Armenians demonstrating in the street?
Well, the main thing is dissatisfaction with government policy and the standard of living in Armenia. So it is very much a case, I believe, that there are haves and have-nots, and the government is protecting the haves. So the system of government, through corruption and other means, is simply tilted towards those people that already have money. What's the result? The result is that a significant number of people living in the country are still impoverished, but the best indicator is people leaving the country. So we know that within the last 10 years, several hundred thousand Armenians have left the country, either to go to Russia or to the United States, temporarily or permanently, because the living conditions simply were not satisfactory.
Now, we've seen in other instances, Ukraine being one of them, there have been uprisings on more Western-aligned groups that are then met with a counter-response from Russian-aligned groups. What is the mood like right now with regards to, are there concerns that Russia might exert some more muscle in Armenian affairs now?
I think there is concern because, as I said before, Russian troops are in Armenia. There are Russian agents, probably some kind of secret police or other kinds of people, that if the government wanted to use them, they could. But I think Serge Sargsyan realized that this was not a move that he wanted to do. He didn't want to fire on his own people. He didn't want to cause a revolution, a civil war, rather, within his own country. So that is, in a sense, kind of moderated the Russian response. But I have no doubt that the Russians are formulating a response, have probably already talked to Pashinyan, the opposition leader, to see where he stands. I believe he's already stated that he does not plan immediately to change the foreign policy of Armenia or its relationship with Russia.
So where do Armenians go from here? How does this play out? This seems to mark a big turning point in Armenian affairs. Of course, you have the fall of the Soviet Union and Armenian independence. And then for the last 20 years, this Armenian Republican Party essentially has been in control. How significant is this, and where do Armenians go from here?
Well, it's hard to predict the future just, you know, perfectly. Yeah. but we're talking about, and many people are using the term, a new Armenia. So there is a new president who seems to be now looking at the situation. And although he doesn't have great power, he has seemed to be tilting towards the protesters. The other issue is that there has to be elections. So May 1st, Armenia will decide its next prime minister. And right now, the Republican Party, which is the largest faction, said that they won't put up any candidates, which pretty much opens the way for the opposition leader Pashinyan to become the next prime minister. But the next step would be then to see if there could be fair elections in Armenia, and that would happen very quickly, and that would change the whole face of the parliament. And if that could be done, then this would truly be a revolution, a bloodless revolution, a peaceful revolution, which transformed the entire country.
How closely are Armenians in the diaspora here in America watching this, and what's the discussion amongst the people you've talked to like?
Well, it's pretty much everyone is following it, whether they are from Armenia themselves or whether they are diasporan Armenians who were born in America, because it affects all of our work in Armenia as well. I mean, the question of working with government agencies or with universities, it was all sort of through the lens of the political situation in Armenia. So people here are following very closely. Of course, now social media gives almost instantaneous reporting. So you get video, you get interviews, and you get analysis. So I would say people are very, very interested in what's happening.
And do we know anything at this point about the U.S. response to this from the Trump administration and the State Department? Have they come out in any way, one side or the other, with what's happening in Armenia?
Well, I believe that they have come out with a statement which pretty much calls for the typical kinds of things, you know, peaceful transition or peaceful. I don't think that they're going to support the previous regime. I think they probably will see what's going to happen because they really don't know who this Pashinyan is in terms of his politics. So it's an open question.
And was it significant that this happened right before the nation observed the anniversary of the Armenian genocide? This happened on the 23rd, the 24th. Armenians here in America and across the globe recognized the horrors of over a century ago. Was that a significant, no, or was that a coincidence, or was that...
Well, I think it's a factor, certainly, but the real trigger was Serge Sarkisian's assuming power as prime minister. I don't remember exactly the day, but it was just a few days before that, 21st or so. So that became really the trigger. Now, people would have come in large numbers to the Armenian Genocide Monument. So it's not hard to say that, okay, people are ready to come out of their homes anyway. And now if they could be somehow, if their efforts could be sort of unified by an opposition leader who speaks to them in their own language, which is that, you know, we want to clean out the previous administration, then I think all of those factors work together.
We've been talking with Fresno State Armenian Studies Professor Barlo Dermirgedichian about the so-called April Revolution that has toppled a political dynasty in Armenia. And the future for that republic will be paying very close attention to that as the Valley's Armenian community watches closely as well. Barlo, thank you so much.
Thank you, Joe.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. The Civil War ended over 150 years ago, but in many ways the battle continues. A new book looks back at history and also contemporary affairs with the rise of white nationalism and the recent events that we saw in Charlottesville. It's by two Fresno State history professors, Ethan J. Keitel and Blaine Roberts. It's called Denmark Vesey's Garden, Slavery and Memory in the Cradle of the Confederacy, a 150-year reckoning with America's original sin. Both Ethan and Blaine join us today. Welcome, both of you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
I want to start out with the subject of your book and then work into the present day. Starting with you, Blaine, who was Denmark Vesey?
Denmark Vesey was born a slave. He lived in Charleston and ultimately was able to buy his freedom. He won the lottery in Charleston and used the proceeds from that lottery to buy his freedom. However, he was unable to free his family. And of course, he was very frustrated by that. He was very frustrated by the fact that he was living under a very oppressive white supremacist slave regime in Charleston. And so he and others decided to plan a slave insurrection. The plan was to rise up in the Charleston area and eventually set sail for Haiti. This slave insurrection was supposed to happen on Bastille Day, July 14, 1822. However, the plot was foiled before it could be carried out, and city authorities ended up executing Vesey as well as his co-conspirators and selling several other participants outside the United States. So Denmark Vesey is a very famous, and to some people in Charleston, infamous black revolutionary. We should say that the book is not actually a biography of Vesey or even really a narrative about his plot. The reason that we put him in the title is that he really embodies one tradition of remembering slavery in Charleston. And that is what we call the unvarnished tradition. This is a memory that holds that slavery was central to the history of Charleston and the United States, that it caused the Civil War, and that it was a brutal, inhumane institution. And Denmark Vesey really embodies and encapsulates that memory. It was so brutal and so inhumane that he risked his life to try to burst the chains of the enslaved in Charleston.
And turning to you, Ethan, it seems like every generation we get new interpretations of history, new memories of the past, sometimes reinterpreted. And there's layers and layers of this story going back to the Civil War and then generations beyond. Help us peel back some of those layers now as Charleston history evolved. Take us to the immediate era after the Civil War. How was the community beginning to come to grips with what happened and its attitudes towards the now abolished original sin of America? And then we'll kind of walk it up to where we are now.
Sure, that's a great question. I want to just add on to what Blaine said, and as a way to get back to the beginning of what we write about. Our central theme in the book is that there's been a conversation going on, a debate, a fight, really, about the memory of slavery in Charleston for the last 150 years, and that there are two rival memories, an unvarnished memory, which is what Blaine was talking about, a memory of slavery as it really was in this brutal, awful, inhumane institution. But there's also been a whitewashed memory, something that was pushed by former slaveholders, their descendants, and others that sought to downplay the significance of slavery, say it was not that important to Charleston, to the state of South Carolina, to the United States as a whole, that minimized the significance of slavery to the coming of the Civil War, said it was about other things. And at times also that sold slavery as a positive thing, as a benign, if not beneficial institution, not just for slave owners, but also for the enslaved, that it civilized them. And that these rival memories have really been competing for the last 150 years. That's kind of our central argument. And so we do start this book at the end of the Civil War in 1865. And one of the most fascinating things that we really discovered as we were working on it is that we had expected that these whitewashed memories, which were really, really sort of took over the country in many ways by the early 20th century, we expected those to really be the chief memory of slavery, the predominant memory of slavery in Charleston almost immediately after the Civil War, but that was not the case. In fact, unvarnished memories pushed by enslaved people themselves and their allies, Union soldiers who occupied the city of Charleston in 1865, Republican political party members, white and black, which controlled Charleston and the state of South Carolina in many ways for the decade after the Civil War during Reconstruction. They ensured that unvarnished memories of slavery couldn't be forgotten. They pushed them into the public sphere, held regular commemorations of slavery that were both joyous celebrations of an end of an awful thing, but at the same time underscored the pain. Things like a large parade in 1865 happens just a month after the fall of the city to Union forces. thousands and thousands of enslaved people put on a huge parade through the center of town, miles long. And it featured a number of, you know, kind of remarkable things. But one was a mule-drawn cart that had a mock slave auction going on. And a man, a former slave himself, playing a slave auctioneer, asking who will bid on these people. And there were four former slaves pretending to be being put up for auction. And you know, to that, what that really did is capture that this was a painful thing that should be remembered as such, should not be forgotten for the destruction it did to families and individuals.
Does that narrative in any way mirror the Reconstruction era? And then after that, the rise of the Klan, the new Klan in that era, is there a parallel, a direct parallel there?
Absolutely, there's a parallel. So this real public display and recognition of the brutality of slavery was very predominant during Reconstruction. So the important kind of factor to keep in mind is that African Americans were politically empowered in South Carolina, particularly. They actually held a majority in the lower house of the state legislature throughout Reconstruction. So they, along with these white Republican allies who had come south, were really able to make sure that the truth about slavery remained in public view throughout Reconstruction. And that's a really important part of the story, to know that that was the reality on the ground. But to your question, absolutely, it changes once Reconstruction comes to an end. And so Reconstruction ends in about 1877, and this was really the violent overthrow of this Black political regime in Charleston by white supremacists, by people who were carrying out violence like the Klan. And so it's at that point that we start to see a real shift in how slavery is remembered in Charleston and South Carolina. And this is when we start to move to these more whitewashed memories, where white Charlestonians, white South Carolinians are able to say, no, slavery wasn't that important. No, it didn't cause the Civil War. No, it wasn't all that bad.
When did the monuments that we now have so much in the news and the headlines last year and even into 2018 now, when did they start going up? Is that a more 20th century phenomena, or what's the history of that?
That's a great question, and something that's often misunderstood when you in the context of the current debates over monuments. People miss the fact that they did not go up immediately after the Civil War. It was decades after the Civil War. It was after this, what's called redemption, the end of Reconstruction in the South that Blaine was talking about, that you know, Reconstruction really comes to a close formally in the end of the 1870s. And it's really not until the late 1880s into the 1890s that you see the an upsurge, a huge surge in monument building. And that first major wave sort of crests by the second decade of the 20th century. So 1890s to 1920s is when you see most Confederate monuments erected across the South and even in other places beyond the South. There'd be a second sort of wave that hits the United States in the 1950s and 60s. And these were the time period matters. The first wave was at the coincided directly with the rise of Jim Crow. The you know, implementation of thorough racial segregation, the implementation of voting, disenfranchisement of African American voters. They at the same time were erecting monuments saying that you know, white people are superior. We're looking back at a Confederate past, that we're showing you who our heroes are, reminding African Americans not only are they second class citizens, but the Civil War wasn't really about them.
Blaine, you're both historians, and the city of Charleston is known across the country for its great historic preservation and many of the historic buildings that are there. Of course, the city did not burn in the Civil War like many others in the South did. One reason that accounts for that historic architecture that remains there today. But you write in the book that also has... there's also a racial element there as well. Tell me a little more about that and how that fits into your chronicling this issue.
Sure. Well, Charleston was really at the forefront of historic preservation nationally. There were quite a few civic leaders, many of them women, who in the early 20th century looked around and said many of our buildings are in danger of being destroyed or just falling down. There actually was not a lot of money in Charleston in the early 20th century. A lot of that wealth had gone away at the end of the Civil War. And so these civic organizations looked around and said, we need to try to preserve some of these old churches, municipal buildings, and homes. And to their credit, they were able to do this. They raised money, they rehabilitated homes, they opened them to the public. And while that's important, it's also really, I think, imperative for us to understand that there is a racial component to that, because the types of buildings that were preserved were the domains of wealthy white Charlestonians. And what was not preserved and what was not interpreted for all the tourists who were coming to Charleston were things like slave dwellings, slave quarters, the kitchens where slaves would have worked. And this mattered. I mean, Charleston sold itself as America's most historic city. It marketed itself that way, and millions of Americans traveled to Charleston really throughout much of the 20th century, and they continue to do so today. And so those decisions that were made in the early 20th century really continue to have ramifications for how visitors understand the history of the city and the history of the South more generally.
And just to, if I can pick up on that, one of the things that first struck us when we started working on this book, we moved to Charleston in 2005, and we would wander around the city. It sells itself as this historical mecca, but the history of slavery was nowhere present. There are no monuments to slavery. The buildings are beautifully preserved, but they don't talk on the tours you would take about the enslaved. And as historians, as American historians, we knew well Charleston's history, and that's one of the things we like to underscore in the book is how central that we call Charleston America's capital of slavery, the capital of American slavery, because it was. More than half of the enslaved people brought from Africa to the United States came through the port of Charleston. That's about 200,000 people. It was a thriving center of the domestic slave trade that removes tens of thousands of people just from Charleston to the Southwest. It was the center of the intellectual and political fight to protect slavery, to defend slavery as a positive good, as John Calhoun famously said. And it was a place where the Civil War started, where the secessionists first held their first secessionist convention, the South Carolina Secession Convention in 1860. That's in December of 1860. It's held in Charleston. It's where the Civil War begins, a war to preserve slavery. And this was entirely lost. It's things have changed over the last decade, but that was one of the sort of main impetus for us to write this book.
Things have changed over the last decade, but in some ways things haven't. This issue has sparked again nationally with white nationalists marching in the street, some affiliates of Nazi parties marching in the street recently. I imagine this, knowing how long it takes to do a project like this, that you began this book before the recent events in Charlottesville, but tell me about how that impacted your work.
Sure. Well, you are right. We started this research years ago. In fact, we really kind of became interested in it when we moved to Charleston in 2005. We lived there for 2 years until 2007 before coming to Fresno. And yes, recent events really, of course, precipitated by the Emanuel massacre, when white supremacist Dylann Roof murdered 9 parishioners at Emanuel AME Church almost 3 years ago now. The real kind of contemporary relevance of these questions came to the fore nationally. How we remember slavery, whether or not we remember slavery, really became a national conversation. But one of the things that we're really trying to prove with this book is that this is a conversation that's been going on in Charleston for 150 years. In a place that was the capital of American slavery, in a place where the Civil War began, they've been debating these issues. So in some ways, it's not really new. On the other hand, it's kind of become more of a national headline since the Emanuel massacre. And I think that one of the things we're seeing is how entrenched these ideas are nationally, not just in the South. We've all seen headlines about how there are monuments in Western states, in Northern states. And so we see communities well beyond the South grappling with the memory of slavery and the memory of Civil War. And that's kind of another theme of our book. While much of this starts in the South, these become national issues. The kind of propaganda that ends up coming out of a place like Charleston has widespread national ramifications. So to give you an example, there was just a study released a couple of months ago by the Southern Poverty Law Center revealing that only 8% of high school seniors nationally can identify or do identify slavery as the cause of the Civil War. That's not a regional statistic, that's a national statistic. And so this kind of memory making that was going on in a place like Charleston has real national ramifications.
Yeah, and you can see that even if you, I've experienced that, frankly, not too long after we moved here to Fresno. I teach the Civil War, I teach classes on the Civil War, and I was asked to write an opinion piece by the Fresno State newspaper editor. It ultimately got picked up by the Fresno Bee, and it was really a reflection on the annual Civil War reenactment that happens every fall here. And I wrote pretty honestly that as a Civil War historian, I'm of two minds about these reenactments. You know, on the one hand, students come into my classroom every year saying how much it sort of grabbed their imagination. It got them interested in history. It got them interested in the Civil War in particular. And I love that. And anything that gets students to come and take history classes, I think, is fantastic. But at the same time, you know, these Civil War reenactments, like, they don't do it to the same degree, I think, as, say, monuments used to or lost cause defenders over time have in terms of whitewashing the memory of slavery. But on the whole, most reenactments tend to push larger ideas about why the Civil War happened, what it meant, to the side and focus on kind of what I would say is military minutiae. Not that it's totally insignificant, but it matters far less how exactly people marched than what's the larger significance of the Civil War? What brought it on? What were the larger outcomes of the Civil War? And those get lost a lot of times at these reenactments, and as a result, they kind of bolster this lost cause amnesia that Blaine's talking about with this recent SPLC report.
Mm-hmm. Blaine, before we go, you mentioned that this has been a dialogue that's been going on for 150 years in Charleston. With that in mind, what can we take away from that dialogue and from Charleston's own divisions and tensions on that issue for the present day?
Well, I think one thing that I would really like to emphasize is that today, people who defend Confederate monuments, who say, no, they're good history, we need to leave them up, the Civil War was not about slavery, those folks, when they get into conversation, tend to say things like, well, you know, you're just criticizing them because you're trying to be PC. They talk about this as a manifestation of some kind of contemporary politically correct movement. What the historical record shows is that this is not new. This is not about political correctness. The historical record shows that slavery was central to our history, that it was inhumane, that it was built on violence. And when you look at Charleston, you can see that the memory of the institution from the earliest days after the Civil War really focused on that fact. And so if you look at the long history, what you can see is that this conversation that we are having today and our attempt to get the reality of slavery told, this is not a manifestation of political correctness. This is simply an honoring of the accuracy of the historical record.
Ethan?
And it's I think, something that can change very quickly. It is an old conversation, but this conversation has shifted dramatically in the last few years. And to me, that suggests that we get depressed thinking about how little has changed, how we can still have these terrible statistics like 92% of high school seniors not understanding the causes of the Civil War. But at the same time, we've seen it was a horrendous tragedy. It's certainly not something we wish would have happened, but maybe, as we write about at the end of our book, maybe the saving grace of that awful Emanuel massacre is that we are having this conversation in a way that was not imaginable, I would say, certainly to me, beforehand. The idea that we would, the idea that South Carolina would take down its Confederate flag that had been flying on statehouse grounds since the 1960s, just a month after that tragic incident, suggests that change is possible, and I think that we have to have change on these issues. That we have to reckon with this part of our past.
The book is called Denmark Vesey's Garden, Slavery and Memory in the Cradle of the Confederacy, a 150-year reckoning with America's original sin, looking at the history of the way that we talk about the Civil War and slavery and its legacy in the context of the city of Charleston, South Carolina, where the Civil War began. It is by Fresno State history professors Ethan J. Keitel and Blaine Roberts. We're so pleased to have them joining us today. You can find the book wherever books are sold. Ethan and Blaine, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that's all for today's Valley Edition. You can find our comments page, audio archives, and subscribe to our podcast on our website, kvpr.org. For Valley Edition producer and reporter Laura Tsutsui, reporters Carrie Klein and Christina Lopez, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, accepting nominations now for the 2019 James Irvine Foundation Leadership Awards at irvine.org. The California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the healthcare they need, on the web at chcf.org. And the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org.